And today we're actually doing Carnival in the Cloud, and we're going to talk to Dave Hornick from August Capital, who is a very experienced investor in general in the industry and also has had some very nice successes in the cloud. So welcome, Dave. It's great to have you. I have this memory of, you know, almost 10 years ago when nobody was blogging and you were blogging.
It's true. I was actually the very first venture capitalist to blog, so it's now more than a decade ago. So I have to admit I've slowed down pretty dramatically. I get on these airplane flights and it's like, I should really write something. And I think, I've written it all. I should just point to things I've written in the past. So.
Yeah. And you know, folks, those of you who are listening, we're talking about a time, you know, 10 years ago. It's probably very difficult for you to envision today. Venture capitalists were these rarefied species that would not talk to anybody. So
yeah.
You cannot imagine how revolutionary the step that Dave took was to actually be so available and so in the face through the blogging platform.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was considered crazy, and you know, hey, this is a black box. Don't tell people what we're doing. And I was like sitting in the black box thinking, really, there's nothing much to see in here, so I might as well let you know.
So what, you've been around, obviously. We've all been around for a little while, and it seems like deja vu again. What's happening? What is your read of the industry? What is your investment thesis? What are you thinking right now?
You know, it's funny. To my mind, everything that changes is back to where we started before. So, yeah, you know what's new right now is that the markets are really great and people are making a lot of money. And so it's like, oh, my goodness, this venture business is a great business. The only problem with that is the things that are great started 7 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, right? So, oh, what a great business. Well, only if you were investing in amazing companies 7 years ago do you get to now take them public and have people see that there's a huge opportunity. So here at August Capital, we sort of take the same view always, which is great entrepreneurs build great businesses. We look for people who are working on things that have the capacity to make a big change, whatever that may be. It may be, you know, we were the first investors in a company called Atheros when there was no such thing as Wi-Fi. And Atheros built a Wi-Fi chip and created the standard that then allowed us to carry our laptops around the house without having a wire. Incredibly transformative, but when we funded the company, it was a science project. And that's true of all sorts of companies where we've invested early with entrepreneurs who have big ideas. My partner, Howard Hartenbaum, was the first investor in Skype when they were just writing the business plan and thinking about peer-to-peer communications. You know, my partner Eric Carlborg most recently was an early investor in a company called Zulily, which is a children's clothing and store. It's an amazing company, but the bigger point was, how do you get direct to the moms and grandmas who are really the ones engaged in the buying of these great products? How do you get them excited on a daily basis? That company went from $0 million to $1 billion, the faster than any company that we have backed before. And that includes my partner, Dave Marquardt, being the first and only investor in Microsoft. So the world is faster today, which is amazing and exciting, but it still requires you to build a business that's doing something great, right? There are no tricks, and we're not looking for tricks. We're looking for great people who are building businesses that solve real problems today, and will create value as a result.
So double click down on that a bit for us and tell us some, you know, thoughts that share some thoughts that are you know, maybe sector specific, or where do you think, what are some pointers to areas where you are either seeing those kinds of opportunities now, you know, now that is going to be get started and 7 years later maybe go public. Where are the new opportunities?
Well, so I guess the short answer is I don't know, and I don't think I'll ever know. That's not my job. I think that the venture investors who think they know what the answer is are either doing it really wrong or they're wrong. If they're doing it really wrong, if they actually know they should start those companies, there's way more money to be made being Mark Zuckerberg than it is someone funding Mark Zuckerberg. So if you know what the answer is, then feel free, go build that company. Otherwise, you're full of it. You don't know what, you know, we meet with, I hear 1,000 pitches in any given year. I receive 1,000 plans in any given year. And they're really varied. You know, it's someone who's working on a cloud service to solve an HR problem, and then someone who's building a consumer experience to bring, you know, 3D VR to your face, and another company that's solving a payroll problem, and another company that's figuring out how to deal with, you know, cement manufacture, right? There's no circumstance in which I sit down on January 1st and say, oh, you know what we need to fund? We need to fund a company that's going to remove wires from laptop computers so that we can check our email in the bathroom. Like, no one woke up the year that Atheros got started and said, that's the opportunity. But when these professors came to our office and said, you know what? RF technology has changed to the point where we can move data through the air with the sufficient efficiency that we can get rid of wires, we said, wow, is that even possible? And the answer was, well, maybe, you know, and so we engaged. So I don't think it's the job of venture investors to say, I think these opportunities exist. I think it is our job to have a broad view of the world, to meet with amazing entrepreneurs who tell us what they are passionate about, and then say, oh yeah, that's amazing. We should have thought of that.
Okay, let me turn the question around and say that if somebody came to you with an idea,
mm-hmm.
give us some insight into your process of how you analyze the idea, how you frame the idea, and how you decide why this is a good opportunity. And we can do some of your investments that have turned out really well, but when they came to you, that was not at all obvious. So what was the thinking hat that you put on to analyze and assess those?
Well, the first piece of that is always, is this a person with whom I'd like to work? Are these a group of people who I think are thinking differently and deeply, who are truly engaged in what they're building, right? And again, this is across a range of opportunities. So I have now been working with an entrepreneur named Rene Lassert for 14 years.
No, Rene, very well.
And he's a great guy. I met him when he was funding his first business. He had just left Intuit. He was building a payroll business, an online payroll business, before anyone had thought to bring any of these, you know, kind of financial services businesses online. And he had pitched dozens of venture investors. And when I met with him, I said, you know what, this guy, you know, we always joke about it that you're looking for expertise. You're looking for a certain amount of understanding of a market when you're going to fund someone. Rene had more understanding of the payroll market than you know, anyone else who would have been starting this business. His parents ran a payroll company. His uncle had sold a payroll business to Intuit. He had run payroll at Intuit. This guy was Mr. Payroll. So you have the market, like, oh man, this guy really understands payroll. Now, do I care? You know, is he going to build a big, interesting business? The way you find that out is really just engaging in a conversation. So Rene and I had a lot of great conversations where he talked about how he was thinking about payroll and how his parents had built their business and why Intuit wasn't doing this and why he thought there was an opportunity. All of these things. Where did he grow up, and where did he go to school, and how did he make the choices he made? And through all of this, I came to the conclusion that Rene was incredibly smart. He was very thoughtful. He knew the market and understood what he was trying to build, that there was a window of opportunity here that nobody was taking, including Intuit. I spoke with all sorts of people who knew him, so I knew that he was an extraordinarily honest and decent human being. So now I have, through that process, I am 90% of the way there. The last 10% is, so is this a good idea? You know, like, that's great. You're an amazing entrepreneur. I'm excited about working with you. And that, and for me, that's that, like I say, is 90% of the battle. Now, what about that last 10%? Is there an opportunity? Can you build a big business here? It you know, will Intuit let them build a business? Will, you know, the classic payroll providers do something to compete, et cetera? And we ultimately decided there was a big opportunity. We were excited about it. We invested in the company. It was actually my very first venture investment. And we ultimately sold it to Intuit for a couple hundred million dollars. And it's been a very successful business for Intuit. They tried to compete. They couldn't. Then Renee says, oh, I'm going to start another business. It's called Bill.com. And I say, great, here's money. You know, what, you know, you're a great entrepreneur. I know it. I've worked with you. I'm excited to, and you're on to this. How do you take financial services business, bring them online? So that's just a microcosm of my process is you sit down with people, you determine whether you feel like they have a real understanding of what they're building. You figure out whether they're motivated by the right sets of things. And I'll tell you what, for me, the motivation isn't I am going to get rich. Maybe you are. Maybe the byproduct is that this worked out and you do a fantastic job. To my mind, great entrepreneurs do not start businesses because they searched around for the thing that will make them rich. Great entrepreneurs care about solving problems, and they have come to a problem that they want to fix for whatever reason. And when you find those people who are engaged and excited, then you want to spend the next 10 years with them, or in Renee's case, 14. And you know, going into 15 years with Renee Lassert, which I am very excited about. I'm excited about 2 decades of Renee Lassert.
So folks, those of you who are interested in learning more about Renee, actually we have profiled both his companies in the Entrepreneur Journey series, and at least one of them is in one of the Entrepreneur Journey's books. So PayCycle is, the interview is with Jim Heger, who went on to run PayCycle eventually, who's also a very good friend of mine. Both of them.
I love Jim Heger. Couldn't be a bigger fan of Jim Heger.
Yeah. So Jim eventually took a scaled PayCycle and sold it to Intuit. And by that point, Renee had already started Bill.com. Bill.com is also a case study. It's not one of the books, but it is in the case study portfolio. So you are welcome to look at it. And really, these are fantastic entrepreneurs. So Dave, question on what you said. Domain knowledge is a big part of your process, yes?
It's a part. You know what? I funded, there are two founders in a company that called WePay that I funded. And I wrote a blog post on VentureBlog about this. And the blog post basically is talking about how do you get credibility if you have none, right? If you're a 20-something-year-old person who's building a business in a very challenging marketplace, and you're not coming out of that universe. So Renee had amazing domain experience, and that's great. Bill Clerico, Rich Aberman, who started WePay, they didn't come out of the financial services world in any meaningful way, but they were incredibly smart entrepreneurs. So to me, then the conversation with them about what they were building was extremely important. And the thing that was interesting is when you ask them questions about how they were thinking about their business, they had very smart answers. They were very thoughtful. They understood the whole landscape. They had put what they were building in the context of that landscape, and they were thinking about it and changing how they were thinking based on the input they were receiving from the market every day. And so even though these guys did not go into this business with extreme domain expertise, I was excited about funding them because they were great entrepreneurs and they had taken the time to make themselves experts. So you don't need to be an expert to going in, but by the time you get to me, you better be an expert. You better know your industry as well as anyone I ever talk to. You better have a point of view. You better know what you don't know. There's no worse thing to tell me than an answer that you don't know, right? It is never smart to, when you don't know the answer, to make something up or guess or whatever. Great entrepreneurs say, I don't know the answer to that, but here's what I do know and here's what I think it will do. And by doing that, you say, oh, okay, this person is thoughtful. They understand all of the inputs around them, and they're going to make good choices as they go and build this business.
And sometimes it's actually good to have people from outside of the domain because they bring in fresh perspective. People from, you know, deeply seeping in that domain may not be able to think a new way of doing things.
Yeah.
All right, so what is your view of the, we've talked a little bit about clouds in the context of payroll, and one of the, we've had several discussions on cloud here, and it, some of the people we've talked to believe that there is still a lot of opportunity, especially in that segment that PayCycle went after, which is the very small business world, to bring more various kinds of cloud services to that world. That seems to be a world that it still has, there are a lot of places where, a lot of types of services that can be brought to it. And my own thesis also is that, you know, we're going through this evolution of modular businesses, right? We are outsourcing everything right now. And it's become possible to outsource everything. So you'd not only buy cloud services as in technology, you could also buy cloud services that come with resources, people, right? Mm-hmm. And that allows you to kind of modularly piece together a business, all the non-core functions of the business, and you only focus on the core, and that those companies are coming together at a fantastic pace right now. So anything that aligns with that general thesis, I believe, are going to create interesting scalable business opportunities. Now, if you look a little bit, I know you invest not only in cloud, but in, across the spectrum. So if you look at outside of the cloud, at the cusp of cloud and mobile, especially this whole app economy with the geo-targeting capabilities and all that, that seems to be a very huge area of interest. However, I'll tell you, I am not impressed with Uber of massage and Uber of laundry. This just seems like, you know, we've been there, done that kind of things. What is your sense?
Well, the thing that's interesting about it, so, you know, first of all, I think the tricky part of the app economy is that there are very few apps that have become big, meaningful businesses. Now, it sort of depends on what you're trying to build, right? If, in my world, we need entrepreneurs who are going to build multi-billion dollar businesses, right? They need to be excited about building a business that could be a public company and worth billions of dollars, because, you know, we're investing lots of money. We're trying to create big returns for endowments and those sorts of folks. So there are plenty of good little businesses one can create with apps, you know, where you can build it on your own, sell it for a dollar or five, make good money. But in the venture world of venture-backed startups, there have been very few apps that have turned into big, interesting things. There have been games that have gotten very large. Those are tricky businesses because, you know, while I'm currently still obsessed with Candy Crush and spend many hours on airplanes playing it, eventually you get tired of the game. And eventually you stop paying for anything. I'm maniacal about never paying a cent to Candy Crush. I'm just going to play through the free level. But it's a tough business model. Instagram, different story. They created a network. They created a social network of people and a bunch of engagement around that. Same thing with WhatsApp. Same thing with Snapchat. These experiences that are uniquely mobile, that give you control and then create huge networks of people, those are businesses that have the capacity to be venture scale businesses. The rest of these things are really tough to make into big businesses. So that's my kind of, don't be a little careful about, oh, I can create an app and I'll build a big business. It's hard to do. To your point about the Uberfication of like everything, I think that everything will be Uberified. You know, I do think that in the end, services on demand are really valuable, that this capacity to use unused resources or underutilized resources all around is valuable. I think we're going to have an interesting challenge as people who are the service providers in this economy try and make a living and are increasingly squeezed by technology and the technology providers. And so, you know, when you were making $18 an hour or $25 an hour driving for a Lyft or Uber, and suddenly it's $10 an hour or $7 an hour, and it's not a good business. And so we need to find this shared space where companies can enable individuals to provide services at a fair price, at a good price to consumers, so it's engaging, but gives them a fair living so that they want to provide those services. And that is across a range of things. And then the economics have to work. So, you know, one of my favorite new startups in San Francisco, I'm not an investor, I'm a consumer, is a company called Lux. Lux Valet. You drive to the city, you pull up the app on your phone, and someone shows up where you stop and takes your car and parks it for you. And then when you're done with whatever you're doing, wherever you are, maybe it's where you dropped off the car, maybe you've gone to several other meetings and you land somewhere else in the city, you say, hey, bring me my car back to here, and they drive your car to you and they give it to you. And right now, they're charging $5 an hour for parking, so less than you're paying locally, a maximum of $15 an hour to park your car. It's a great deal. Now, the only question is it a business, right? I'll use it for sure. And I'd probably use it at $20, not even $15. But can you afford to hire people to come get my car, drive it off to some site where it's cheaper to park, get them, bring it back to me cost effectively enough that you make money on my $15 while paying those salaries? And that's true of everything. It's the Uberification of delivery, the Uberification of IKEA furniture construction, whatever, you pick it. Are there real businesses? Are the individuals providing the service going to get paid enough to care? And is there enough margin that you can actually build a business in the process?
So there's a great article, I don't know if you've seen it, in The Atlantic just in the last couple of days about what really makes Uberification of all these different services possible. Mm-hmm. And good analysis is actually what the author says, I can't remember who wrote it. The author says it's not technology, because the technology is not rocket science, which I agree with. Mm-hmm. It is the fact that huge numbers of poor people are available to do services, deliver services at very cheap rates. And he goes on to say this all was available in Mumbai many, many years ago. And it's true. You know, yeah. If you're in India, my mother calls up the grocery store, the bazaar, somebody will bring the fish at home, somebody will bring the vegetable at home, no problem, you know. This is a very different way of existence, a very different way of life that America is just discovering through this Uberification process.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting question, right? Is it bad news because it's creating this services economy of cheap labor being underpaid? Or is it creating sufficient efficiencies that we can all get services we want from people who are going to get well paid for doing it because the efficiency is taken out, right? The efficiencies are created so that suddenly it makes sense to drive around in your car and act like a taxi. Whereas before you'd be like, I can't get the customers. It's too expensive to insure. You know, I can't deal with credit card processing, all those things. So I do think technology matters, but you're right. And we have this, right? That you back to your cloud services thing. You know, one of the things that cloud services have figured out is that because it goes to the web and pushes away from you, the providers of the end product could be anywhere in the world. And so we have doctors and technicians reading MRIs in India. We have accountants who are doing work for you in other places around the world because they're very competent professionals in other places that are paid less to do the same services. Again, is that a good thing for the world economy? Are we able to bring up the standard of living for, you know, technicians in Mumbai who are reading x-rays, or are we just pushing down the price of everything and driving down the value of everything to the point where no one makes a good living anymore?
Well, this is the classic globalization debate, right? Things are great for those in the Philippines providing those accounting services, but things are not great for the people in America who used to provide those services at a completely different price point. That's what's going on. There is wage compression going on in America. There is wage inflation going on in India. This is the reality of today. And,
yeah.
And that's kind of economics. You can't fight that trend.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true.
The one thing that I find very annoying, however, of what venture capital allows entrepreneurs to do is ignore fundamentals. And I think there is a very bad habit in venture-funded companies, including these Uberification stories, of ignoring fundamentals and delivering services at rates that are not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's bad investing, right? I mean, in the end, all of these companies that have gotten funded have presented a business plan where people have said, oh, I get it. I think that at scale, these things work, or if you have sufficient density work, whatever. There's always a theory that it will work. Now, maybe the theory in an upmarket like today is, don't worry about it. We get a bunch of users. We'll get value for those users. So ignore, you know, monetization and all of those things and just grow a big user base and we'll be fine. Now, it turns out that is true in a certain very, very narrow set of circumstances. Those companies that are massive, right? We're investors in a company called Wattpad, Wattpad, and it's a storytelling platform where people are writing stories, posting them to Wattpad, and then reading them on Wattpad, serialized stories about Harry Styles or whatever. So you can say, hey, look, we're not going to worry about when you start this app. Oh, we're not going to worry about it. We're just eventually we'll get to a sufficient scale that that we can monetize people, but we're just going to build a big business. Now, if you were to pitch that business that way today, I think people would say like, oh my God, how are you going to get to sufficient scale and all that stuff? On the other hand, right now, Wattpad is, there are tens of millions of people reading on Wattpad billions of minutes a month. So I can tell you today, Wattpad is of a scale where they have no problem monetizing, right? So if an investor at the early days of Wattpad said, don't worry about it, we'll get there eventually, just figure out how to create a great consumer experience, they would have been right. But for the first however many years, people could be sitting there going, what idiots, you guys are going to go out of business. You are making no money. You have a small number of users and you're busy focusing on the consumer experience, right? So I agree with you. I think that it's important to have a view of a business where at scale or in an area or whatever, you can get to some big reason to get to a business, right? And that means it has to be self-sustaining, right? You have to see somewhere in the future where you make more money than you spend. And if people are funding companies that they can't see that time, they can't envision a time where that company makes more money than it spends, they're dumb. They should not be funding those things. But if they see that out, but it's in year 7, and then you have to spend a bunch of money from year 1 to 7, then the only question is, do you think you can raise enough money to get from year 1 to 7? And that's the bet.
Hmm? That's a big question.
Yeah, it's a huge question. And, you know, I have companies that go out of business as a result of that, right? That make that bet. And then it turns out in year 4, there isn't money to get to year 7. So
right.
It's the danger. It's the high wire act of entrepreneurship, which is, man, I need this thing to work, but I can't run out of money, but I want to build a big business, so I want to make big bets. And it's hard.
Yeah. You know, the concluding pointer I'm going to make for everybody on this topic is a piece that I just published, and it was in our newsletter this week, Will Capital Kill Capitalism? And the question that I raised there is, we are by putting so much capital into businesses, we are allowing entrepreneurs to spoil consumer habits. You know, if consumers kind of only expect things for free, like you said, Candy Crush, you're never going to pay for it. And I mean, me neither. I don't pay for Candy Crush kind of shit. But the truth is that consumers expect value for free. And that kind of destroys the basic tenet of capitalism, which is producers produce value, consumers pay for it to consume value. Now, if we destroy that basic relationship between producers and consumers at scale, then we are left with a welfare society.
Yeah, I think it misses a point, though, for what it's worth. I spend a lot of time talking with people about business models. Oh, what's the business model? Are you approaching some unique business model? And when you dig into it, there basically are – there's only one real business model, and that is that you have consumers and they pay for things. Now, you're saying, oh, you give these things away for free, so that's not what's happening. Well, the reality is that there are proxies for paying for things, right? So we know one of those proxies, and that is that that advertisers pay for the attention of someone. So you get it for free, but you have to deal with advertisers. And it's explicit these days, because if you want to listen to Spotify without advertisers, you pay for it. And otherwise, advertisers get your attention.
Advertising business model works fine, except that you have to have scale to be able to monetize with advertising. Little shit doesn't get monetized very well through advertising. Right? But the danger that is being created is more on the freemium side. You know, freemium became a fad, and it's neither here nor there, and freemium conversion rates are terrible. That's where I think the problem is getting created.
I agree with you 100%. I agree with you. I think that freemium is a bad, in the vast majority of cases, very possibly even Spotify, freemium is a bad business. Freemium is a bad model that results in millions of dollars being spent on a theory, and the theory is that if you make it free, it'll be easier to acquire customers, and then you'll be able to convert them. You'll be able to upsell them to some paying instance. It turns out that free doesn't make it that much easier to acquire customers, so you're not even getting the value of the free, and it's not that easy to upsell them to paid. So there are very few instances where the freemium model has worked, and in those instances, it's because serving your free customers is cost next to nothing, right? Skype worked because the computer-to-computer communications were free. They used other people's resources to pay for it. When you paid, when you needed to get actual value by being out to the landlines, out to the POTS system in other countries, then you had to pay. And that worked, right? But Dropbox or Spotify or a bunch of these companies where it costs real money to serve the customers when they're free, it is a challenge to then get this model to work.
Dangerous. On that note, thank you, Dave. That was great. I'm so glad that you reinforced that point, because this is a point that comes up all the time. And I'm like you. I'm a strong believer in actually monetizing and not giving stuff for free. So I'm glad you reinforced that point. And it's a real pleasure to have you.
Thanks.